Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Welcome to Bristol's first podcast, Dialect, which goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on BCFM. This week, water pollution, and somebody who used to work for a government department on the subject believes that there is actually quite a lot of pollution around that we don't know about. Also, victims of miscarriages of justice are growing, in part due to the extinction of investigative TV documentaries, such as the BBC's Rough Justice. But fear not, to the rescue comes Victims Unite website and editor Sabine McNeil. And we start this week with someone called Chris Baskerville, who's joining me on the line. Hi, Chris. Chris, can you just give us a bit about your background? What was your previous job?
Yeah, I used to work for the Water Pollution Research Laboratory, which was a government agency, which was founded in the 1950s, and I was there from 1959 to 1981 as a research officer. Come the privatisation of the water industry, we were given the option of doing our own thing, which is just what I did, and I used my expertise in the water pollution field, which included visits actually to Bristol Avon Mathews Works and Thornbury, to actually see if we could get their plants running a little bit better than they were. I then set up my own research laboratory, just particularly why do illnesses attack some people and not others.
The Water Research Laboratory, where actually was it? Was it in one spot or in different parts of the country?
No, it was initially in Stevenage, and then they moved to Swindon, and there they call themselves the Water Research Centre, which is part of the funded by the water industry. But in the days when it was at Stevenage, it was part of what was called the Department of Scientific Industrial Research, and one of the 70 laboratories all around the country, which used to be governmental research laboratories, giving advice to the central government on how to deal with problems like air pollution.
Hang on. Did you just say 70?
There are about 70 DSIR research stations there were, and we've gone down to about, half a dozen perhaps or so.
Well, give us an idea of some of the other laboratories that used to be around that we've lost, as well as your own.
Well, dozens. There used to be, incredibly, a British Launderers Research Association, which was an association to look after laundries, and there was even one called the British Whiting Research Association. And you wouldn't credit this, but that wasn't anything to do with fish. It was just due to titanium dioxide and pigments, and it was called the British Whiting Research Laboratory. Some of them were perhaps a bit superfluous, but I'm afraid others, which are now no longer with us, including one, the Warren Springs Laboratory, which was directed to look after air pollution, and that was closed down in about 1990.
Now, it would seem to me these are fundamental things we need to know about, water pollution and air pollution.
Absolutely.
What's the difference now, the way things are run outside the government? So it's not taxpayers funding it, it's the industry itself. That seems to me a little bit dangerous, because you've got the people you're researching on are actually paying your wages, so it makes sense, surely, to have a bit of independence from them.
Well, absolutely. Vested interests ensure that negative information is never brought out into the wider to the wider, but not to the wider public. And fortunately, me being totally independent since 1981, I can actually do exactly what I want to do, which is exactly what I've done. And then I scratch my head and think, "Wow, what the hell's going on here?" And then, of course, you write it up and send it off to government laboratories and say, "Oh, that's of interest." And then here I am 30 years later, and still the problems that I'm very worried about are not being looked at. And that's why I'm chatting to you now.
So, OK, tell us about some of your research over the last 10 years or so. You've come out with quite a lot of interesting stuff, which I think the private water companies, like here we've got Bristol Water and various other Wessex Water, privatised water companies,
are the sort of
information that maybe they may not just be quite happy to hand on to the public.
Yes, but to a certain extent, that's not quite right, insofar as I've used my expertise of water pollution and used the analytical methods of the water pollution industry in order to quantify the problems that I've been looking at. For instance, what causes allergies, what causes the immune system to fail, why do illnesses attack some but not others. It's not water itself. Well, I analyse water, I have to bring everything back to a water phase, because that's the only thing I know much about. I'm a sewage treatment research specialist, so I have to bring any pollution I'm trying to determine in the environment, I have to bring it into the liquid phase and then analyse it as an industrial effluent, and then think, oh, that's interesting, where the hell is it, where's it coming from?
Okay, Chris, you've been looking into formaldehyde. Tell us what you've found, and also how the water industry and various publications, professional journals have received, and even newspapers have received that news.
Formaldehyde is an essential component of all living organisms, not just human beings, animals and plants. It is also an air pollutant, but without it, we're all dead. But if we have too much of it on our bodies, or too much of it in the air, ideally we want nothing in the air, then we suffer terribly, and this is, in my opinion, the cause of much illnesses. Illnesses, I think, is caused by the correct level of formaldehyde in the actual body. If it is too much, then one's hyperactive and suffers diseases. If it's too little, as they say, one is dead. And it's because this product, formaldehyde, this organic chemical formaldehyde, is what's called paramagnetic, which means that it is attracted to a magnet. The brain is, I think, controlling this level of formaldehyde within the body, and the electrical impulses are actually controlling the right amount. Unfortunately, when something actually superimposes the electrical activity from the brain, then our body chemistry goes haywire, and we get allergies and spots and diseases and such like. And the problem is, this is a whole new concept as far as the medical industry is concerned, and the knowledge of chemistry is not very great. The water industry, they certainly should be in the lead to actually sort out what I'm saying to you as being nonsense, or it is, everything is correct.
Well, what about this balance then? How do we know whether in our water there is a correct balance of the right amount of formaldehyde?
Once again, I must redirect you slightly insofar as the water which I measure is the condensed water that is produced from dehumidifiers. This is the water you get in a fridge or from a dehumidification unit, or sometimes goes on the floor of supermarkets.
Okay,
when the drain
so
is tunneled.
It's not coming out of the tap. This is stuff that's in the air that you're then condensing.
Coming out of the dehumidifiers that I actually put in people's houses in order to quantify the pollution that is present in their house.
And to what extent is that actually coming via the water supply?
I don't think it would come at all from the water supply. It is present in, it's present outside, it's present inside. Indoor air pollution is at something like 10 times the concentration as from outside. And unfortunately, by actually draft-proofing our houses, we are making the problem very much worse.
Okay, well, the best thing, of course, is to make sure there's no formaldehyde or the correct low levels in the house in the first place. But Chris, just a second. And how do we actually do that? Because I know for a fact that, for example, clothes, when you buy clothes, sofas, kind of thing, are actually treated with formaldehyde so that they can have a long shelf life in a warehouse and in the shops before we buy them.
Not just that, but they do actually impart crease resistance to the clothes. When they say drip dry or crease resistant, there is a product which is put in there in order to stop it being creased. The trouble is this product, which then breaks down and gives off formaldehyde, which then comes out in as an air pollutant. You're actually getting molds growing inside of windows because microbes use formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is a precursor to sugars, and indeed, when it joins together in molecules, it actually forms sugars, and this is why molds grow. And incidentally, it is people who lick windows who are called window lickers, the ones who don't care what people think of them, they're slightly subnormal.
Hang on, Chris, I must pull you up on the window lickers, because this is something new to me. Most people would definitely think twice before they started licking the inside of their window.
Well, that's right, but those people who are with an IQ, low IQ, of course, they don't care as to what other people think of them, and therefore they know that the toffee goo that forms on windows is jolly sweet. So they do it, and they say that it's a term of abuse, I'm afraid, but nevertheless, they actually know that there is this sugar there, and so do bugs and microbes. Incidentally, the green goo you get on caravans and outside, that is also due to the formaldehyde being used as a substrate, as a food for the green algae. And it's everywhere now, of course, as you probably know. I mean, your patios and your conservatories get covered with this green goo. And that's interesting.
Yeah. What about getting rid of it? I mean, particularly from clothes. Can you just put it in the washing machine and use ordinary biological or non-biological washing powder to get rid of this formaldehyde, Chris?
I am continually arguing with my wife when she buys new clothes, all neatly pressed, and the first thing I do is put it in the washing machine. And no. But you must do that. Always, always wash new clothes. Because if you don't, the first time you wear them, and to be fair to the clothes manufacturers, some do say, always wash new clothes before you wear them, because the formaldehyde comes from the breakdown of the resin that is used to impart crease resistance. And you're talking in terms of 700,000 to 800,000 parts per million of formaldehyde in these clothes, and you will react to 1 or 2 parts per million, so that you don't stand a chance if you're sensitive, that is. Because it is an essential component of all living organisms, you and I are actually producing it. If we produce it in normal amounts, we're perfectly healthy.
And are you saying then, Chris, that sometimes electrical things like, for example, a mobile phone mast or maybe even the radio transmitter that people are hearing this over or the internet can actually make our brains not actually able to understand the formaldehyde around? I seem to be thinking that actually what you're saying is that the electrical interference in our modern world actually could be causing us to not be able to deal properly with formaldehyde.
Well, absolutely. What is actually happening is it is causing the breakdown of those crease-resistant resins in the clothes and in furniture. MDF, for instance, is medium-density fiber and such like. But all these are evolving gaseous, small concentrations of formaldehyde, which is causing indoor air pollution. The best thing you can do to actually alleviate the situation to a certain extent is not to draft-proof your home. Have a slight draft, and indeed the office I'm talking to now has got a through draft, so that I can knock the concentration down by a factor of 3 or 4. I can't get it down to the same concentrations outside, but because books and magazines and clothes and people, don't forget people are producing it as well. And we get, some people, of course, react to people, don't they? Oh, God, I'm not happy here. I must get outside in the fresh air. This is because they react. But the wonderful thing is that the water industry, by actually having very good analytical techniques, can actually quantify the problem, which I've been doing for the last, say, 30 years.
Chris, whereabouts can listeners go to find out more about this?
Well, if they can try... I am a 73-year-old carer of my wife, who's 75. I can't clearly set up a whole new research laboratory. Try to find somebody who understands the chemistry of what I'm talking about, if you can, and act from there. But tips that I would say is to make sure you don't draft-proof your home too much. Always try to have a through draft. Of course, in yesteryear, when people had coal fires, the air in the house only stayed in there for about 2 hours. Nowadays, when we're draft-proofing our homes, we have 24 hours or even 48 hours. And that means the contamination levels are actually 10 times, 20 times greater. And this is causing the problem of allergies and asthma, and much, much worse too. Because I cannot get any acknowledgement from those who ought to be aware, and three of the laboratories, government-led laboratories, who would have been able to understand what I'm talking about, have been closed down in the last 10 or 15 years. And I have submitted evidence to numerous public inquiries on the degree of the problem that we are facing. And I have been saying to myself, this has got to get out. It can't die with me. And that's why I'm making this contribution to your program now. And I must say, it's not the water industry has got something to congratulate it for. It gave me the knowledge to let mankind be aware of the degree of the problem. I've now got to get people to actually take me seriously and try to confirm my results that I've got, indicating this terrible problem. because science can only be validated if 100 other people can get the same result. Just me is nothing, is rubbish.
Okay, and just remind us, Chris, of a simple ways to get rid of this formaldehyde from our homes if we want to.
But, first of all, wash clothes at as high as temperature is acceptable, because the higher the temperature, the more you decontaminate.
Does it make any difference whether it's biological or non-biological?
I don't think it makes any difference. Always have a top light window open if you possibly can. Clearly, you don't want to freeze to death. Air conditioning is absolutely wonderful. Exercise. Particularly early in the morning, these exercises, they say, of swinging your arms down, because you've got to decontaminate your body, remember, as well as your clothes. Never, ever wear new clothes without being washing them first. I know some people cry at that.
Chris, I know you think that this is related to quite a lot of different illnesses, don't you? Can you just run through them?
I am challenging what causes the disease. I think a disease occurs in an animal, or a human being, or a plant, when the chemistry is adequate, when the environmental habitat is suitable for that attacking organism. So that, for instance, everybody who has got the Asian flu, everybody who's got the plague, everybody has got a common illness will have a common biochemistry. Now, to my mind, this is quite obvious. I mean, you can only live if the environmental habitat is adequate for them. And I think what orthodox medicines are doing are actually changing the environmental habitat. Penicillin, for instance, or anything, any treatment which works, actually changes the body biochemistry, which I can measure, which we can measure, by actually analysing the change in body biochemistry. And so, incidentally, also does complementary medicine. I mean, whether it's yoga, or laying on of hands, or acupuncture, will actually change the body biochemistry, so the bacteria or the virus, I don't care what it is, attacking the person who's suffering will say, oh, you've changed my environmental habitat, I'm going somewhere else, or they can't thrive. And this change in state of body biochemistry, which can be proved analytically using the techniques of the water industry, can establish as to whether what I'm saying to you is a load of rubbish or actually true, worthwhile to listen to.
I think one of the things I particularly like about your approach, Chris, is the way that you say, don't necessarily believe me. What I could be saying could be a load of rubbish. I think that's very refreshing.
30 years ago, I was assured by the Department of Health, by the Minister of Health, that my ideas were actually being given considerable consideration. We view your views with considerable interest. But last year, I got a similar reply from the Department of Health saying, we have no plans to conduct further research. It's quite disturbing. Nevertheless, using the techniques of the water industry in order to quantify the problem and to analyse what is the cause of these high indoor air pollution levels.
And I think the other maybe lesson to be learned here is not to close down important research labs like yours.
Well, absolutely. One doesn't know why they're closed. Partly, of course, is because of the decline of the British industry insofar as how many laundries are there in the country at the moment and how many paint manufacturers are. Probably none. There's probably very few launderers. However, the ideas that we produced at our own laboratory, I think I personally, myself, invented sufficient equipment to actually pay for the whole of the laboratory from the time it was started about 1920 to when it closed in about 1990. And that was just one simple idea, which is now used right through the whole of the water industry all around the world.
Okay, Chris, well, thanks ever so much for joining us. That is Chris Baskerville.
And I hope I haven't disturbed people too much. There is something you can do. Try to find somebody who understands what on earth I'm going on about and try to reproduce the information and then hopefully we'll be able to help people, not just in Bristol, but all around the world.
Chris, thanks very much.
Fantastic. Thanks so much indeed for letting me on. Bye-bye.
Asked a girl what she wanted to be. She said, baby, can't you see? I wanna be famous, a star of the screen. But you can do something in between. Baby, you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Baby, you can drive my car. Were good, and she said, baby, it's understood. Working for peanuts is all very fine, but I can show you a better time. Maybe you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Maybe you can drive my car. And maybe I love you. Can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Baby, you can drive my car. And maybe I love you. I told that girl I could start right away. When she said, listen, babe, I got something to say. I got no car and it's breaking my heart. But I found a driver and that's a start. Baby, you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Baby, you can drive my car. And maybe I love you. Beep, 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 yeah. Beep, 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 yeah. Beep, 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 yeah.
The Beatles there with Drive My Car. Now, on our regular slot, we have from victimsunite.net website, Sabine McNeil. Hi, Sabine.
Hi, Tony.
Now, you've added a little bit to your website this week, haven't you? What's that about?
I have added a new platform, which I really love, called Meetup. The only unfortunate thing, it was invented by Americans and is run from New York, but it's a really, really nifty platform which brings lots of people together, certainly in London. I keep going to wonderful events. And so I am using it for Victims Unite now to announce court hearings, because it is terribly important, especially litigants in person, get supporters in the public gallery. It's important for them and it's important for judges. I have seen it work. When judges refer to the fact that there are people in the gallery.
Well, so I think there may be, it may be true to say that some judges are quite happy and maybe others less happy with having people in the gallery. But, I mean, what does that actually do for someone who's involved in a court case to have a, you know, particularly if they are a litigant in person, to have other people just you know, sort of hanging around? I mean, they're only really observing, aren't they?
Litigants in person have learned to help each other and become what are called McKenzie friends. There was a case, McKenzie versus McKenzie, that introduced these lay legal advisors, and we formed an association of McKenzie friends amongst the kind of key victims turned star fighters turned McKenzie friends, so that we can kind of advance the cause a little bit. So by putting this extra meetup page together, I hope to attract not just sort of supporters who are curious and in life cases, but also an opportunity for McKenzie friends or people who have acted as McKenzie friends to change news, to exchange their views, and to learn from each other, because there's always more to learn, especially in court cases, especially in law, and there's a lot of experience necessary to tell the wood from the trees. Ironically, I've just been sent a judgment this week where a judge refers to a hallmark of litigants in person, that they can't tell the wood from the trees. And I've observed that, I've seen that, that and how victims cannot describe their own case in a short and nifty and, if you like, journalistic style. And in court, it is as necessary to get to the essence of what's really important and significant than all of those surroundings. And it's really, it helps to be supported on emotional as well as legal levels.
What about the idea of going to court? I mean, to going to court hearings for most people, Sabine, that is one of the most boring things people in the world would ever do, is actually sit in a court case where they're not even involved themselves.
I'm sure that's true, but if you know the people and if you know the case and if you know that they're innocent, then you are interested in watching and see what happens. I mean, the worst that I have seen was this case of the Nigerian couple who's totally seven children were taken. It was a completely staged scenario. Somebody from the court, the staff, actually told one of our supporters that the jury was rigged. I mean, and one of our more experienced McKenzie friends said that the lawyer should have declared the judge should have declared his interests. I mean, those are the kind of rules one doesn't know about. And so it's not boring if you know that the people are innocent, and if you know that, especially, and this is in these terrible child snatching cases, when not only are the parents deprived of their children, but they're being criminalized. I mean, that's how I've learned not only to go to court, but also to prison.
Now, I've noticed over the last few days, I mean, particularly last, I think it was Friday, in the Daily Mail, there was an announcement in some of the other national papers that the police are taking much more seriously some allegations made by Tom Watson MP in October in the House of Commons about a very high-level paedophile gang, possibly connected with this place called Elm Park Guest House in southwest London. And as part of all that, you know, you've got... they're actually now saying that there's at least one person who is the head of social services in some part of the country, they're not saying where, that was part of this gang. Do you, I mean, is that something that's credible in your eyes?
Yes. I've seen another blog post where it is alleged that council officers were involved in the supply of children. I've known for a long time that this child snatching takes place either for money or for sex or both. And I can't tell you the overlap. In other words, it may be enough for all of the local council employees to just get a kickback in other words, just money. And I have some statistics about the money aspect of child snatching, but I don't have statistics about the paedophile aspect, of course.
Now, I mean, you know, one of my aspects of sort of looking at this is, you know, you look at a lot of the things that the government does, they don't really seem to do it very well. I mean, for example, in the defence industry, we've just sold a load of these Harrier jump jets off at a ridiculously knockdown price to the United States. This was year before last, I think, and just after having spent billions refurbishing them, selling them for far less than even the refurbishment cost to the US. I mean, you wonder, don't you, sometimes whether there is any real checks and balances in the state looking after our sort of common heritage and our common land and our common taxpayers' money. A lot of it seems to be a bit irresponsibly managed, and I wonder. I mean, obviously, this is much more dangerous when it comes to looking after children in care.
Yes, I think it is the ultimate absence of accountability and responsibility in public offices is what one needs to tackle ethically. But of course, that's where the whole culture of "I'm just doing my job" has to be questioned. And that links back to the money. I mean, if its creation isn't honest, then it creates dishonest practices. And back to my hobby horse that the government should create its money rather than the banks. And of course, ultimately, I feel that the banks hold governments to ransom with their public debts. I had a really interesting realization because I spoke to a lady who is fluent in Russian, and anybody who has some idea about multilinguality. In German, the word for guilt and debt is virtually the same. And there's a different word for interest on money and for interest as being interesting for the mind. So it so happened that I have said on the same day a German blog post by somebody about a camp in between 1945 and 1947 in Germany, run by the British Secret Service. It made me think that the economy where interest is made out of thin air by vested interest is the real mechanism. But in Germany, however, there is this, the national guilt has to be reinforced over and over, as if everybody alive now had to do with Nazism at the time. Germany and the UK have the public debt as to suffer as the mechanism with which to hold governments to ransom, and that is the ultimate tragedy. The absurdity of the national debt was already criticized by a Duke of Bedford, I think, in 1947. I mean, it is just horrendous. And I spoke with somebody not so long ago and asked him about why has the UK become such a kind of a poodle to the US? And he said it's thanks or due to the Marshall Plan, which is, of course, the same thing what happened to Germany, i.e. everything post-war too. But that's a long, it's a long way from away from the children, but it's about, if you like, abuse of power position, not ethical accountability of the position of power of anybody, whether it's in a local council or in the Treasury or in the Bank of England.
Well, yes, I mean, maybe we could just wind up, Sabine. Just remind listeners that Sabine's website is www.victims-unite.net. That's a dash in the middle between victims and unite. Sabine, just from a sort of outsider's point of view, looking into Britain, I mean, I know you obviously spend most of your time here now. From an outsider's point of view, I mean, we're often sort of told, well, you're too close to Europe and Brussels, and then we're told, well, Britain is too close to the US, and we're sort of torn between the two, aren't we? What's your view on what Britain should do in that sort of, in that tug of war?
Oh, thank you for that, asking that question, because I've always felt it would be nice if the UK kind of stood her ground between the US and Europe. I mean, obviously, we are geographically we are closer, but it seems that in the scheme of Anglo-Saxon capitalism kinds of things, and the UK is too close to the US, and that is certainly reinforced by the SME Innovation Alliance, whose website I'm editing as well. Those people who are all into technology, the high end of technology, they are very, very, very upset about the fact that they basically say that the UK have become the research labs for the US. And then after World War II, you know that how the U.S. Got hold of all of the German brains. And so it's close, but of course, currency-wise, the euro shouldn't have happened, or not the way it is being run now. So I just wish there was more understanding in both. In governments involved, actually, about money and public debts.
I mean, do you think it makes sense for governments to control the money in their own country, or to go for one of these big currencies like the dollar or the euro?
No. Of course, they should do it either themselves, and they should issue, and they should. Every country should do it for themselves. Absolutely, no doubt about it. Because there is always money is also a very cultural thing. It is very peculiar. I open bank accounts in 5 different countries, and of course in America anything goes. And this is not the case in Europe in general, which includes the UK. And therefore, every country should do it themselves. Absolutely, no doubt about it. The kind of ethics are different. The climate makes a difference of how long hours you work. In the hot countries, you can't work at lunchtime, and so therefore, the economies are bound to be different. And therefore, every country should do it in their own way, of course.
Okay, Sabine McNeil from victimsunite.net, thanks very much. I'll speak to you next week.
Okay, bye for now.
Now I'm joined by Peter Galambos. Hi, Peter. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi, thank you very much.
Now, you've got a fantastic voice there, Peter. Tell us about how your voice is working for you.
Thank you very much. I'm proud of it a bit. Yeah, this is my profession. You know, I'm from Hungary, and I'm usually a station voice and a voice talent. Actually, I'm an actor, but working as a station or dubbing voice.
So if someone is driving around in Hungary listening to the radio, they may hear you. What sort of context?
I was a radio presenter too, like you, but not this good.
Actually,
if somebody hear radio or watching television in Hungary, hear my voice as a dubbing actor. I'm dubbing so many films, you know, with another Hungarian layer of the movies. Also in commercials, so many commercials. I'm official voice in Hungary, the T-Mobile mobile phones.
Oh, really? Okay,
yeah.
So tell us a little bit about Hungary. I mean, it's a long time since the sort of collapse of the Soviet bloc now. What's Hungary like as a country?
It's a hard question, because it was, you know, the newborn of democracy was Hungary in the 1990s. And it's 25 years ago, and we tried to build a new democracy, but now so many people think the new government tried to make a new kind of half-fascist regime now in Hungary. It's not the best way, I think.
Okay, so tell us about the basics. How have they changed since this new so-called liberation of Eastern Europe? Things like housing, things like the price of bread, all these very basic things. How have they changed?
You know, capitalism is coming for our country and collapsed Soviet communities and try to connect to Western Europe, and that's why we can buy so many new things, new kind of cars, German cars, English cars, and the prices go up, and you know, the people's money is the same level, but we're trying everybody hard working and we are happy to chance to traveling. Maybe
is it easy to get work? I mean, is there quality in society in Hungary?
Because
that's one of the things that really makes for a healthy society, is basically it should be fairly equal.
You are very optimistic people, but it's not true. Tried, you know, Hungary's tried too, because our region tried to connect, but usually we can't now. You know, the economical disaster in Hungary, there is economical disaster too, and our jobs is to, everything is low. Everybody try his own way, them own way, but it's very interesting. In last year, from Hungary moved about 200,000 people to West countries. I don't think so. It's the best way to be a good democracy and a good economical place.
That was Peter Galambos, and he'll be doing the What's On Guide a little bit later on. Now joined by Jason Yannakopoulos, who's our electronic internet guru. Well, how do you mind being called a bit of a information guru?
I'd rather not. I'm slightly worried I might be contacted by some rather nefarious people.
Okay, what about stories this week? I know one of the ones you've brought to my attention is that the army is going to be cut, something like 20 or 30,000 soldiers to boost their morale.
Well, yes, it does boost their morale a lot when they're not being shot at, I suppose. You know, congratulations, you did a good tour in Afghanistan and managed to stay alive. Now you can sit at home and never be shot at again.
So if they're in a foreign country and someone else's country occupying it, I mean, that must not be very good for morale. Also, if their politicians that are leading them aren't very good, and also if their generals aren't very good, their morale's got to be at rock bottom. So what is it, do you think, that actually cutting the army so much as well, some would say that's also going to be bad for their morale?
Well, I don't know. I'd rather be in a working place where I'm not being shot at regularly.
Out of the army is being good for morale. So there's no chance of being in the army and having good morale.
Well, I don't know. You know, they're quite aware they're being shot at. You know, maybe it's one of those things that they're all worried about, that they're going to get fired or laid off soon. So pretty much like the rest of us.
Joining everyone else on the dole queue, including the Remploy people and everybody else. So I don't know how that's quite going to be paid for. But
maybe a few Conservative MPs will join them soon. You never know.
I'm sure the government know what they're doing.
Of course.
Now, what about the way this is affecting the royal family? Because we just had Harry come back from Afghanistan, allegedly.
Harry came back after killing a few.
Did he actually kill anybody? This is the question, isn't it?
Well, we don't know, but But maybe we'll give the papers the benefit of doubt. Maybe we won't. I don't know. So they said he killed a few Taliban commanders. So you know.
Is this going to be good for international relations? Having
probably not, because while he's out there, Harry is, if anything, a walking target.
But okay, so what he's doing essentially is just making sure that the Western drug cartels can still farm Afghanistan from all its heroin to poison our streets, and that's some sort of heroic that Harry's been doing.
Yeah, pretty much. I really can't put it better than that, actually.
I mean, I must admit, I do have some sympathies with the Taliban, simply because it's their country. Do you think I'm being a bit over the top?
Well, you have to remember that Taliban are fairly religious right wing, so...
Well, yes, honest, they are, yeah.
It's a battle of two... pretty evil powers, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah, but I mean, ultimately, this is one of the things that I would pat the Taliban on the back for, is that they actually pretty much stopped before 2001 and the invasion of Afghanistan, pretty much stopped the drug production in that part of the world. And there's a lot of people that would point at the Vietnam War as being actually the US was only interested in Indochina because it was another place that they could grow narcotics.
Yeah.
Jason.
No, it's shocking, and it's probably some way to find the real truth about why we are invading these countries.
Now, another bit of news this week is the suicide, or supposed suicide, of Aaron Schwartz. He was an internet guru, rather like yourself, Jason.
More of an internet guru than I'm ever going to be, to be fair.
Are you into the Eastern religion and these gurus and that kind of thing? Anyway, so he was also someone who invented the RSS feed, which is the idea is that you can have an RSS feed is something you can have on your computer, which tells you every time. In fact, Dialect Radio has its own RSS feed, which is done exactly the same every week. It pops up, and if you want to subscribe to it, it's a way of reminding you every time Dialect appears online. What are your thoughts about internet freedom generally? Because this guy, the worrying thing about this is that Aaron Schwartz was about to, it seems, win a case against the US government and win loads and loads of money in compensation too.
And then all of a sudden he mysteriously commits suicide. So, you know, it's very dark, isn't it? I mean, I don't know of many people who, when they're about to win lots and lots of money of government, suddenly decide this is a bad thing and then suddenly commit suicide, you know?
Bit strange.
It's a bit dark, isn't it? And as far as internet freedom goes, internet freedom is something that should be preserved. And it's worrying times now that we're getting things like SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, which would have restricted the freedom of the internet, and a very bad thing, in my personal opinion. It's quite worrying. I mean, Wikipedia.
Now, SOPA sounds like something you stick under your armpits in the shower, but actually,
what was in the fact it's soap with PNA for the switched over.
Okay, you got one on me there. The point being that we have now had an announcement that the Sun this week, the Sun's defence editor. This is the Sun newspaper. Virginia, what's her second name?
Virginia Wheeler
has been arrested. Now, I don't know. There seem to be almost every couple of weeks another Sun journalist is arrested.
Well, it's odd. In this case, she lent an extraordinary amount of money to. Gave an extraordinary amount of money to a policeman who was from the Metropolitan Police, who was quite willing to provide her with information about certain cases. I think there was the case of a 15-year-old girl who had been killed, which was paid for.
So almost instantaneously from defence editor to defence solicitor.
more like straight from defence editor to defendant.
Yeah. Now, I'm one of those slightly cynical people that thinks that the Murdoch papers, even though the journalists are mostly now arrested, apparently, are still managing to produce a newspaper every day. Would you like to explain how this happens? Is it some kind of computer fantasy story generating thing in the background?
I think the journalists are more than capable of making up if they want to, and they probably have other nefarious back channels that haven't been discovered yet. So,
Well, we shall see. What about the wider Murdoch Empire?
Well, you know, maybe my views on the Murdoch Empire aren't exactly fit to be broadcast on public.
Okie dokie. So that means that, for example, the Sky News at the top of the hour on this radio station provided by Murdoch, a very trustworthy source, do you think?
I'm sure it is, yes.
I noticed they have lots of sport as well on the news,
well,
and they tend
really
to be very celebrity-based. It's interesting, actually, the way the news has changed on this station in the two or three years I've been on here. You know, it's actually much more celebrity than they used to be right at the beginning. beginning.
Well, that's the same, really. I mean, it's they're always taking the cue from commercial radio stations who are much more the same. And actually, coming back to what I said a few minutes ago, you can't make up much about sport. I believe, what's the name, Lance Armstrong did that for quite a few years, you know?
Oh, yes, it's horrid the way that whole business is to me, it's just the whole thing stinks. And any publicity that man, or maybe we shouldn't have even mentioned his name, because he just feeds off of it. Now, the next story is, he's going to be rehabilitated and everyone's going to love him. End of story, end of career. And this is, I think, one of the very, very good arguments for if anyone is caught doing doping, then that should be the end of their sporting career. Yeah, I don't think there's any question about it being more. You know, if someone is a cheat, then they shouldn't be in the sport. Thanks very much, Jason. Speak to you again next week.
Bye.
Hello, this is your Watson Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 25th January, Larry Miller will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 25th January, Ruth Royal will be performing with support from Lenny Savage and Rebecca Clements at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £3 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Goldblade. This group formed in 1995 in Manchester, and during their career they have released 5 albums. This is from the Drop the Bomb, which was released in 1998, and is the song 16 Tons.
Cashing cash or freeze, cashing or tossing, crashing the ash of a burnt out dream. Busting minds of a chemical rush, turns through flats with lifestyle bust.
That was Gold Blade with 16 Tons from the album Drop the Bomb, which was released in 1998. For more information of them, you can check out www.goldblade.com. Into Saturday, 26th January, Her Dark Embrace will be performing with support from Reventure and also AWMR at the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 27th January, Spin Doctors will be performing with support from Natural Tendency and Retrospects at the Fleece in St. Thomas St. Bristol.
Tickets are £15 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That is all for me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, I think you did very well, Peter. Your first live bit of recording and also an English lesson too.
Thank you.
You're in Bristol for how long is it, Peter?
For 5 more weeks.
Okay, so before you go back to be the voice of T-Mobile in Hungary, we shall be hearing a little bit more from you, I think.
Okay, thank you.
And that's all for this week's show. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday. If you're outside Bristol on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. Just sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, Dialect Radio, one word, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guests, Jason Yannakopoulos, and you just heard there from Peter Galambos. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And as promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, 01454 318 753. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye.
The choir will now sing What a Friend We Have in Jesus as we offer a silent prayer for success in tomorrow's onslaught.
God, the prospects for a successful attack are now ideal. I place myself in your hands.